Want to welcome everybody here tonight. We appreciate you coming, and we'll appreciate we'll introduce our wildlife. The chairman of the Wildlife Board is here tonight, Dr. Woodward. If you'll wave the crowd, appreciate you being here tonight. And Tanya, thank you for being here and helping us with, as y'all. We need to have approval of our agenda. So let's talk about our agenda. Has everybody had a chance to look at the agenda? And is there any additions or corrections or modifications we need to make before we call for a vote to approve that? Not seeing any, I'll call for a motion to approve the agenda. Anybody?
I'll make a motion.
A second. Thank you. All in favor? It is unanimous. Thank you. Let's see. Let's talk about our minutes. Has everybody had a chance to review our minutes? Any corrections or modifications to the minutes need to be made? Not hearing any, we'll call for a motion to approve those minutes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd make the motion we approve the minutes from...
Second that.
Richie Anderson made that second. All in favor? And it is unanimous. Next on our agenda is the Wildlife Board update. Just tell you what we did there. Thank you. The last Wildlife Board meeting, the deer numbers, I guess, of the central and southern region checked in about half of the mule deer as normal at their check stations. And those that they checked had poor body conditions. Most likely drought was the factor there. The other regions he reported were about normal. Kobe Jones gave a presentation on a couple of the of surveys that had been completed. One of them was moving the archery hunt to overlap more of the rut. They sent that to about 3,900 hunters, about 8 questions on the questionnaire. And the overall results recommended no change. The Wildlife Board did request that a calendar be put together by the division of possible season changes to include a little bit more of the rut, and the division agreed to do that.
That's not good.
And he also gave a presentation on the survey that was done on a once-in-a-lifetime goat hunt. The results of that showed pretty positive, as long as the permits were not taken away from the rifle hunt or the any weapons hunts. So they were pretty supportive of that. And that's the up until the action items. The first action item was the statewide mountain goat management plan, and it was very well received as far as the committee that was put together for that. Committee was handled and the negotiation that was took place there. I think everybody walked away. They might not have walked away happy, but they walked away satisfied that they did the very best they could. And on that one, the next one motion was made on that to approve the statewide management mountain goat management plan as presented, and it was 5 in favor, 0 opposed, and 1 abstention. Kevin Albrecht abstained. He's with the Forest Service. The next action item was a statewide bighorn sheep management plan, and a group of, I'm guessing, 15 or 20 people got up on that one, too, and they were all very supportive of the way that committee was handled, and they, too, was very... appreciative of that, to see the sportsmen come together and the wool growers and the agriculture group come together like that. It's kind of fun to be a part of to see that happen. But there's a motion made on that to approve the statewide bighorn sheep management plan as presented, and it passed unanimous 6-0. There was a couple things inside that one that hadn't that. Was they agreed upon. They agreed to have a management of understanding be created so that everybody understood exactly how things were going to work, and they felt a little bit more comfortable in the legal way with having that understanding. And so that's going to be completed. And also there was a part of that plan allows the sheep herders or the livestock folks to take a bighorn sheep on site if it's with their domestic sheep. And that was one of the concessions I think some of them made, that the Wool Growers Association and some of the agriculture folks really appreciated. And there was a motion made by the Wildlife Board to have the division report on those two things at every Wildlife Board meeting until both of those were completed. And the one I see completed on the take is until they understand exactly how that's going to work. If they take one, how they got to report it, and then those kind of things. So, and that motion passed unanimous, 6-0. On the Bucks Bulls once in a lifetime hunts, there were several motions. One of them was on the Barney Top archery only elk hunt, as we talked about in our last RAC meeting. That's part of I'm in the middle of the Boulder unit, and there was a motion to approve that with a class of 4.5 to 5-year-old bulls. There was no second, so that motion failed. There's another motion to approve that hunt with a 7.5 to 8-year-old bull take, and that actually failed, 2 in favor, 4 opposed. And then there was another action. There was a motion to add to the action log an item for the division to complete a proposal to take a look at that and see if that's something that should be done. And that motion passed to unanimous 6-0. There was another motion. You know, we talked about what is a primitive weapon here in our RAC also. There was a motion made for the division to come up with a definition of what is a primitive weapon. You know, is it a spear? Is it a long bow? Is it, what is it? Is it muzzleloader, flintlock? What is it? And so that passed to unanimous 6-0. So they'll be coming up with that. I think that was due to the RAC by the April meetings. There was a motion for the limited entry once-in-a-lifetime archery only Rocky Mountain and Bighorn desert bighorn sheep hunts, adding those units, and as we recall, there was one to the for the Rocky, it was Box Elder in the Newfoundland Mountain, and for the desert, there's the Zion unit, and that one passed 6-0. A lot of discussion over the spike rifle hunt in the different units. As you recall, in ours, there was a lot of discussion whether we ought to try to not have that hunt any longer. There was the southern unit, the southern RAC had a motion to keep the rifle hunt, the spike hunt in the Book Cliffs, and it passed their RAC. There was two other RACs that passed a motion to keep the rifle spike-only hunt as it is, and those two passed. So there's a lot of discussion in that. And when the dust all settled, they had added the spike hunt to the Monroe unit, so which it was taken away 4 years ago. So all the limited entry hunts now, they kind of fixed. Is that wrong, Doc?
Yes, it's wrong.
It's wrong, but I reported it correctly, right? Okay. So anyway, that's where that ended up. The where we was kind of headed. It looks like they had that to the Monroe, and that motion was unanimous 6-0. And then there was a motion not to have an early season deer hunt on the Panguitch Lake unit. And that failed, 2 in favor, 4 opposed. There was a motion to include the additional boundary that was proposed by our RAC, the Northeastern RAC, for the Uinta Basin Extended Archery Unit. And I think you recall, we added some land on the other side of the river. And it passed unanimous, 6-0. There was a motion to approve the balance of the plan, and it passed 6-0. On the CWMU topic, there was a motion to approve the Meadow Mountain and Double R CMUs. They had some late applications, and it was approved unanimous. And then there's a motion to approve the division. The rest of it is a division presented, and it was unanimous. As far as the dedicated Hunter Rule Amendment goes, it passed 5-1 as presented. The waterfowl amendments and rule amendment, it passed unanimous as presented, except to limit the e-bikes to a class 1, 20-mile-an-hour limit, which I think we talked about quite a bit in our last meeting also. And then there was a topic that we didn't talk about that was presented that they voted on. It had to do with the Flaming Gorge Reservoir Rule Amendments. There was an agreement change in that which doesn't allow out-of-state or non-resident residents to purchase a reciprocal stamp between here and Wyoming. Evidently, if I understand it right, you could buy a Utah non-resident license and then fish in Wyoming, which is a lot cheaper than buying a Wyoming one and a reciprocal stamp for Utah. And so they just made it to where non-residents cannot buy reciprocal stamps, I think, if I understand that right. And just for your knowledge, any fishermen out there, Wyoming has raised their reciprocal stamp $20 in addition to what it already is at $10. So next year going forward, you'll be paying $20 or $30 for a reciprocal stamp in Wyoming. Utah's has stayed the same. There's no change in Utah. But you can get online right now and buy a 2019 stamp for still $10. So I did it today. So you could save yourself $20 if that's what you want to do. And I think that's a wrap. That's all the notes I had taken. So that's a report for the wildlife meeting. I turn time for to Boyd Blackwell for our division update.
Okay, good. All right, some of the things going on in the region. Our law enforcement are currently down an officer again. We have a hard time going longer than a year, it seems. We get officers that like it in other places, or we need to make a change. And so we're down an officer. It was in the Vernal North, Randy, is that right? West Vernal? Yeah.
Is a regional supervisor too rough, or what's the deal?
Well, the regional supervisor doesn't scare these guys, I'll tell you what. So, yeah, so we're down one, but they've got seven guys that have made it through the rigors of the interviews and all the stuff, the tests and things that go through, and we'll be going through post. And so there's a good chance that we'll be back up again, and we'll be happy about that when that happens. From our aquatic section, this is just kind of a heads up. It's not anything serious. It'll be between 2022 and 2034, so it's a ways off. I probably won't be here when this stuff goes around. It's way down the road, but the U.S. Forest Service has partnered with the division and that completed a wilderness EIS. It was done, and that was done several years ago, but they want to get information out to the public again. The proposal is for the division and the Forest Service to treat numerous lakes and streams in the High Uinta Wilderness Area. Now, we've started on the North Slope, and we've been working hard on that. We've still got some more to go. We've moved around to the South Slope, and we're treating those to remove brook trout and restore native Colorado cuts. and this is part of our state's efforts to keep the species common so that it doesn't get listed under the Endangered Species Act. The drainages that we'll be treating at that later date, at that time, will include Fall Creek, Audison, Oweep, and Garfield Basins. So, like I say, it's down the road, but there's quite a bit of stream up there, and people are used to going up there, but we'll be treating it and putting it in, and they'll be coming back. The streams will be back for our sportsmen. Okay, our outreach section will be conducting and coordinating, well, they'll mostly be coordinating the 14th annual Oray Christmas Bird Count this Saturday. If you're interested in going out and helping to count birds, and if you're interested in the little brown jobs, and come on out. And December, you'll know I won't be there. I just called them a little brown job, so I don't, you know. But the counts will start at 8 in the morning and until they're finished. Tanya loves the birds, and so she'll be there. And she was excited to do this. So our wildlife section, we've got our depredation issues are starting to mount. With elk pushing into the lower elevations. In my estimation, forage availability is poor. And these elk are moving down into a lot of the farmers' and ranchers' fields and haystacks pretty much all across their winter range right now. The guys are working at night to help. You know, we have a lot of tools. Well, we have quite a few tools in our bag to be able to try and help landowners. And we're doing things that we haven't had to do for a while, and they're out shooting and removing even deer in some places where we have resident deer that are causing problems. They're shooting and removing elk in some places as well. And so, it's one of the things I really don't like to do. No one likes to see this happen, but it's one of the tools that we have to use. They are being extremely responsible, though, in donating the meat. A lot of people are at this time of year are very happy to get some elk meat or some deer meat. And so they are in the process. We have a list, and if any of you are interested or know people that are interested, have them call the office and ask to be put on that donation list. We just go from top to bottom and make a phone call, and hopefully if they answer and they want it, they get it. If they don't answer, we just move to the next person down. So, and that's a good thing. So, biologists have been working hard on deer capture and collaring projects in different areas on the south slope, and we'll be moving out to the Buck Cliffs. Clint, when?
Next week.
Okay, next week. And if you're interested in seeing that, get a hold of Clint and ask him where that's taking place. There's been different things on the news. There's been different videos that have come out, and it's pretty cool to see. So come on out and take a look if you'd like. They're also wrapping up their classification. I think they're probably pretty much through that now. Is that right? Yeah. So they're wrapping up their classification. So there used to be a time when the work slowed down just a little bit this time of year, but not the case. The guys in this region, they just love work, and you can't get them to not accept a project. They're great. Great, great, great staff. So that's everything, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, boy. Appreciate that. A lot of good stuff. All right, we'll kick off with our first action item. Darren Dubois, our mammals coordinator, is going to give us a little bit of information on the 2019 black bear recommendations and rule amendments.
Hey, Randy, could you turn that light there off? We'll just leave that one on. There you go. Thank you. It's amazing how those bears can use those lips.
Thanks. Good evening, everybody. I'm glad to be here tonight. I always put off. Yeah, this is hard. Thanks. I'm going to be presenting our black bear recommendations for 2019 tonight. I wanted to quickly go through a little bit of background on how we manage black bears in Utah. I like to do this just so everybody's on the same page, since we don't do this more than once a year. First of all, the division's mission, thank you, it's been too many of these, I think, is to serve the people of Utah as a trustee and guardian of the state's wildlife. And part of the things that we do to achieve that mission is to actively manage wildlife populations, and bear populations are no different. Hunting is a key component when we manage populations, and so we'll be making recommendations about bear hunting tonight. The black bear has been a protected species in Utah since 1967, and we did a lot of research beginning in the mid-80s. We've done research longer than that in Utah, but really geared up a lot in the mid-80s. And a result of a lot of that research, some of which, significant amounts of which, took place here in this region on the Book Cliffs, we undertook an effort in the late 90s to put together a management plan for black bears. And we had a group put together, a black bear discussion group, that represented a good cross-section of stakeholders and interested groups. And as a result, in 2000, we put out the first black bear management plan for Utah. That plan was in effect, and in 2011, that plan was reevaluated. And we made some changes to that and came out with the current plan, which began in 2011 and is effective through 2023. And that's the plan that guides our bear management strategies at this time. So what does the plan say? First of all, the main goal of the plan is to maintain healthy bear populations in existing occupied habitat and expand distribution, while at the same time considering human safety concerns, economic concerns, and other wildlife species and impacts that bears may have on those other species. And we define a healthy bear population as one with a proportion of breeding age animals that will maintain population levels consistent with habitat and also maintain genetic variability. And so having this goal in mind, we set some strategies in the plan in order to try to accomplish this. And is that we will manage bears on a 3-year harvest recommendation cycle. And the reason that we do this is because black bear biology is such that, you know, bears are long-lived, relatively slow reproducing. They usually don't produce their first cubs until they're like 4.5 on average. So compared to other wildlife species, production is slow, but populations don't tend to cycle and spike and jump all over like maybe some of our other species do. And so you really want to look at a more long-term cycle when you're managing bears and not make changes every year. One of the reasons the plan recommends not to go with annual changes is one of the things we do, and you'll see tonight, we try to do a harvest or a population reconstruction based on our harvest data. And in order to do that, you have to be really careful about changes in your harvest rates. If you have increasing harvest rates, you can confound the results of that. And you may appear that you have a growing population where when actually you're just harvesting increasing numbers of bears. And so we try to keep to the plan identifies that we should be on this three-year strategy. So every 3 years, we look at the last 3 years of data, and we evaluate it. I'll not go into a lot of detail here, but obviously if anyone has questions about details, we can do that. But basically, just in a nutshell, we harvest bears on a unit by unit basis across the state. Those units are identified and put into certain management categories: light harvest, moderate harvest, or liberal harvest. And in order to what category they fall into depends on what our management strategies or management objectives are. Light harvest is a unit where we maybe have a small number of bears, a relatively small number of bears. We want to allow bears to grow. Human conflict is low, and so so our objective there is to allow that population to grow. Moderate harvest, most of the units in the state fall under moderate harvest as per the plan. And that's where you have a good bear population. You may have a little room to grow, but you're trying to maintain and keep it stable. And still human conflict is relatively low. Liberal harvest units are usually units where we have a lot of concerns about human conflict, primarily depredation to livestock, and you're actually trying in those cases to suppress those bear populations and address concerns about conflict. Depending on what strategy you use and how your harvest data falls into the adult males and females category, then we make recommendations for permit adjustments based on that. Another thing we did this year, last year as part of this recommendation cycle, we had a couple of issues that made it through the racks, made it to the board, and the board asked us to consider as part of a longer process. Primarily the Book Cliffs and LaSalle San Juan hunting seasons. So in order to do that, we convened a discussion group to talk about those issues specifically. And since we had the group together, we also discussed a few other specific things. We talked about opportunities for spot and stock hunting during the fall. We talked a little bit about the bait stations and some of the registration requirements. We talked a little bit about non-resident pursuit during spring season. We also talked about with livestock producers about their concerns regarding bears. This is a list of groups that were represented in that process. Some of the results of those discussions you'll see in recommendations tonight. So moving on to some of the data. So since what you see here are the statewide success rates and statewide harvest numbers, this is sport harvest, since 2014. We average in Utah, between 40 and 50% success overall. That's actually one of the highest rates in the West. Other states have different hunting methods and constraints, but we have a fairly high success rate for bear hunting in Utah. And then you can see the harvest numbers there. They've been increasing, but we actually saw a little bit of a decrease between 2017 and 2018. So if you put that into a graph and run it all the way back to 1990, this is kind of how our numbers have looked over time. The red line are the number of bears that we've harvested over time. You can see that little bit of a drop. It kind of spiked, and then now it's back to the level it was in 2016. And then the yellow line are the number of permits we've issued over time. So you can see that we've been increasing. One thing that's worth pointing out, in 2011, we had the new bear plan put in place, and you can see that three-year harvest cycle. Then we made an adjustment. We've gotten away from that a little bit over the last few years for a few different reasons. This will be meaningful here in a minute when we get to recommendations. This is the population trend that I talked about. What we do is we look at the age of harvest and back calculate those. So, you know, if you have 5 4-year-olds in a given year, you know that you had those that were alive and in the population the year before as 3-year-olds and so forth. So that's what this is based on. This doesn't include natural mortality. This doesn't include cubs and yearlings. This is just adult bears 2 years and older in the harvest. But the really useful thing is the trend. That line may shift up if you include other forms of mortality, but the trend won't change. And so you can see since about, oops, that's the wrong button. Since 2008, we've seen an increase in the bear population. It appears over the last few years it's probably leveled out somewhat. That's statewide. The other thing that we take into consideration when making these recommendations are our depredation, is depredation by bears on livestock. And what this graph shows are the amounts of payments that we made by county last fiscal year, so from July 2017 through June of 2018. And then you can kind of see where the hot spots are throughout the state. San Pete, Carbon County, Utah and Wasatch really stand out. This is primarily depredation on sheep. That seems to be when we have bear damage, that those are the folks that are affected the most. When we do have depredation concerns, what we try to do is to allow sportsmen to take those bears in those situations. And so what this graph shows, I'll get used to the buttons here in a second, is the number of bears that have been taken by Wildlife Services, which is a federal agency that helps livestock producers with predator management, and then the number of animals taken in sport harvest. And this has remained fairly stable. There's probably a slight increase over time. But, you know, with additional bears, we've afforded additional opportunity for sportsmen, and we try to allow sportsmen to take those bears in those situations. So on to recommendations. Our first recommendation tonight is that we get back to the 3-year recommendation cycle that's put forth in the plan. And so our recommendations tonight will be for 2019 through 2021. So what that means is that we would make permit adjustments on the 3-year cycle. So our intent here is to keep things the same until 2021. There is a safety valve, if you will, built into this. If we do see some biological concerns and we need to make changes, we can always bring those, bring recommendations to the board during the 3-year cycle to address those. We've done, Upland Game is done this way now, and when they had some turkey issues, they brought those to the board. So we try to keep things consistent, but we're not locked in if we see an emergency. If we need to do something in a shorter time frame, the division director can close seasons as well. The next recommendation I'm going to introduce here bears a little bit on opportunity for hunting and the demand for permits over time. And so this is a graph that shows the number of resident applications, the red line here, compared to the number of resident permits available over the last decade or so. And you can see that that's diverging. This line, if you remember some of those other graphs that show the number of permits available, you know, the difference is big enough that line just flattens out. So we're seeing a divergence between demand and the availability of permits. This is the same graph, but for non-residents. Same pattern. So one thing we'd like to we're recommending tonight to try to address this in some aspects is to offer fall spot and stock only permits on selected units. You'll see that when we go through our unit by unit recommendations. And we're proposing that that season open with the beginning of the general muzzleloader deer season and then run through the end of the any weapon muzzleloader deer season. So it would overlap big game seasons in the fall. The thinking here is that if a person wanted to hunt big game and a bear at the same time, this is a boot hunt, so they wouldn't be able to use dogs or bait. They'd just have to spot and stalk, as is indicated by the name, I guess, that they could do that. We have a couple of strategies we're going to try. One is to offer permits through the draw. So on some units, people will put in for those permits. If they draw the permit, then they can hunt that season. On some other units, we're going to try a harvest objective strategy. That doesn't address the disparity between permits offered, and at least not in terms of bonus points, but it is additional opportunity, and we're going to try the quota system on some other units and see how each of those work out, which one seems to be the better way to go. In order to do this, on the units where we're offering this opportunity, we're going to have to eliminate the early baiting before the late November, that November season. And the reason is that it would overlap with this spot and stock season. And so we don't want to have baits in the field with people that are not supposed to be hunting with bait. And so that is part of the recommendation. So you'd be able to, if you want to hunt that season, you just start hunting on November 2nd. You wouldn't be able to place bait in the field early. Just as an indication of what we'd expect success-wise, we currently have these opportunities on the LaSalle's and the San Juan, and success rates over the last 3 years averaged about 10 to 15% success currently. So we'd expect probably somewhere in that neighborhood. If a bear unit has a lower population of bears, it may be a little bit lower than that. Season dates. There are a couple of seasons that we're changing. All the rest are the same, just adjusted for calendar. So on the booklets, Bitter Creek South, this was one of the things that the discussion group took up, and we came up with a compromise in that group. We're recommending that we eliminate the archery-only season on the booklets, Bitter Creek South. Open the fall season the first Sunday in August and run that season through November 14th with no dogs allowed from the opening of the limited entry archery season through October 1st. So what this essentially does is give houndsmen a couple of weeks in August to hunt that unit before it closes for the archery seasons. And that's in order to avoid some conflicts that we have with archery hunters. And then it would open again on October 1st for houndsmen. You could still hunt bears spot and stalk with that permit during that season or with bait, but not dogs. We're also recommending that we change the LaSalle and San Juan spot and stalk seasons to match the seasons for these other units. So from the opening of the muzzleloader deer season to the end of the any weapon deer season. And again, all the other hunts they're in the tables in your packet, but they're not changing from what they were last year, dates-wise. So on to unit-by-unit recommendations. If it's green in the notes, that indicates a change. So on the Bookcliffs, Bitter Creek South, we're recommending 65 permits. That's an increase of 9 over last year. On the Three Corners West Daggett, on the South Slope Bonanza, Diamond Mountain Vernal, 3 quota spot and stock. So just to be clear, what we're talking about here is over-the-counter permits. Anybody can buy that permit, hunt that unit. But once we hit 3 bears taken during that season, the season would close. So the permits are essentially unlimited, and we're using a quota. In the northern region, we're recommending that currently the northern region has 2 conglomerations of units. And so what we want to do there. We've got some units in the northern region that are primarily private land, and over time we've had discussions about concerns of private landowners and bears and livestock, and trying to provide some tools for those landowners to solve their own problems. After much discussion, we came up with this solution and this recommendation. What we're proposing is that we split the units in the northern region between largely public and largely private land units. So Cache, Ogden, Camas, North Slope, Summit are our public land units, and Chalk Creek, East Canyon, Morgan, South Riches are our private land units. We're proposing harvest objective permits in the spring and the fall on the private land units in order to allow landowners, if they have a bear that's a problem, to go buy a permit over the counter and hunt that bear rather than have to draw a permit. There still are some draw permits on that unit during the bait season. We don't do harvest objective seasons with bait. We're also proposing on all of these units 5 spot and stock permits in the fall. The Camas North Slope Summit currently has a conservation tag on it. It includes the Chalk Creek, and so just, you know, if the RAC wants to weigh in on that, feel free, but this is something we'll need to work out between the board and the conservation group. And that's something that'll happen. If the RAC has any suggestions, we'd be happy to hear. In the central region, 20 spot and stock permits on the Nebo, and 2 additional permits on the Wasatch Mountains West Central. In the southeastern region, Central Mountains Manti North, 20 spot and stock permits. On the South Manti San Rafael North, 20 spot and stock permits. And on the 9 Mile, 10 spot and stock for the spot and stock season. Southern region, 2 fewer permits on the Beaver, 2 more on the Dutton, 3 on the Panguitch Lake Zion, 1 additional on the Paunsagunt, 20 spot and stock permits on the Plateau Boulder Kaparowitz, and 2 additional on the Plateau Fish Lake Thousand Lakes. Those are our permit and season recommendations. Now we're moving on to some recommendations for rule changes. The first is we're recommending that we change the language in the portion in the agricultural crop depredation section of the rule that allows a landowner, lessee, or a designee — that's the difference, the designee part. So a person that has chronic crop damage could designate a hunter to help them with that particular animal that's causing the damage. This is strictly to address depredation concerns. So the landowner wouldn't be able to charge someone to do that, and they wouldn't be able to keep the bear. The bear would have to be turned into the division within 48 hours. There is an option that a person could buy a control tag from us and keep the bear. But again, this is — the use for this will be to address crop depredation, primarily in the southeastern part of the state when they're getting into melons or sunflowers. The next recommendation we're making is a result of some concerns we've heard on during some of our seasons where people are hunting or driving the roads all night trying to locate bears outside of legal hunting hours. And so we tried to address those concerns with this suggested change. So we're recommending that we add some language to the legal hunting hours portion of the rule. That dogs may not be rigged 1/2 hour after sunset to 1/2 hour before sunrise, except during the summer pursuit season when dogs may be rigged beginning at 5 a.m. So, and rigging is defined in the rule as to have trained dogs placed outside of a dog box, kennel, or crate while being transported in or on a motor vehicle, and this is key, for the purpose of locating or pursuing a bear. Again, this is try to clarify what we mean by what kind of activities could take place outside of legal hunting hours, and to try to set some ground rules so that everybody's on the same page. We're recommending that we modify the firearms and archery equipment portion of the rule to match the changes made in the big game rule that allow air bows, and so that's just to make everything consistent. We also added some language to clarify when dog handlers can retrieve dogs that separate from the pack during pursuit. We had a little bit of contradictory language in the rule and guidebook, depending on whether it was a restricted pursuit unit or a regular pursuit unit, and so we wanted to make that consistent. We added some language to the baiting portion of the rule that clarifies that a person may not intentionally start rig dogs at a registered bait station or take with dogs a bear lured to a bait station. The rule didn't include the caveat for intent before, and so we're adding that to it. And we sometimes have people that don't realize there's a bait station there, and when they set the dogs out, they wind up at the bait station. And what we want to do is make sure people aren't doing that on purpose. We changed a little bit of language in where bait stations may not be placed. Currently, the rule says 100 yards from water or a public road or designated trail, half mile from a permanent dwelling or campground. And then there's a little piece about anywhere that the division feels like a conflict may arise. We felt like the 100 yards and half mile was sufficient, and we didn't need that additional language. It left a little bit of room for interpretation that we don't feel like should be there. So we're recommending we remove that part, that language. Changed a little bit in the bear check-in portion of the rule. Used to say that bears could be checked in at a regional office or by a conservation officer. We hadn't been doing that in practice. We have biologists that check in bears and technicians. So we're changing the conservation officer part of that to division representative. And we're also requiring the exact location of kill when a bear is checked in this is one of the objectives in the plan, to build a database with this information so we can better understand how bears are being taken and where they're being taken on the landscape. That's it.
Thank you, Darren. We'll do this. We'll have a question session first. So if you have any questions, be thinking about those. We'll call you up here in just a second if you'd like to. We'll start with the RAC. Any questions by the RAC?
What's the current strategy of the three harvest strategies on the book cliffs?
Moderate, right, guys?
Yeah. Moderate.
Yep. Yeah, roadless is light. Yeah, yeah. It's split into two units, so that roadless is light.
Other questions?
Yep.
Do we have a spot and stock in Little Creek, or did that?
It's strictly, yeah.
Because okay, I didn't see that on there. So
yeah, that wouldn't be a change. That's currently spot and stock only, yeah.
Okay. Other questions by the RAC? Yep.
What do we foresee as far as the drought conditions for cub reproduction this coming year and for the future?
With bears, that can be a cause. Bears are long-lived. All they really need to do is produce one good litter to maturity in order to replace themselves. But you do see sometimes in drought conditions, they'll go a couple of years without reproducing. What did you guys see in the dens this year? You might want to actually plan out maybe over the last, the plan identifies the 5-year time period for denning. So if you know that.
Clint Sampson, wildlife biologist. I'm just going to talk really loud. So as far as the dens go, last year we currently have a 31-year-old female collared in the book cliffs, And she hasn't had cubs, I think, for the past at least 5 years, I think, that I know of. The other one we acquired from the Southeast region, she was a capture and relocated extremely. I think she's only like a two-year-old bear, so we weren't expecting any cubs with her this year. The Southern region, they had three bears that they denned, and all three of those, the one before, I think, had yearling cubs, and then the other two didn't have any in the den. And so, yeah, that's what we have for collars. We'll see if we can get maybe some more. I think the plan, the new management plan, Darren can speak to that as far as how many bears we're going to try and collar. But as far as their body condition went, that older bear, she's in some of the best shape I've ever seen a spring bear be in coming out of the den. And the younger one looked extremely healthy too.
It seemed the one place where we detected the lowest reproductive rates was in the Southeast and the LaSalle, where it's been the peak of the drought down there. But I think everywhere else in the state, they saw some reproduction this year. And we do plan to get more bears on the air. We've committed to get more collars out.
Other questions, Brother Rack?
Yes. The tags, would you have to have a big game tag to hunt spot and stock?
You can just do that, yeah. But I think we just thought, just timing-wise, that might be a good time to do it because people would want to be in the field. But, yeah, you could just get a permit and hunt bears if that's all you wanted to do.
Okay. One other question. On the Book Cliffs, some of the other regions had quotas, and the increase of 9 in the Book Cliffs, why not a quota there? And why quotas? What's the criteria for quotas and non-quotas?
It really is just kind of a strategy. Sometimes it's difficult to get harvest on some of these units, and so they try to, with a quota, you can put more people in the field. The region can speak to their specific strategy, but they have those options in the plan, and so it's just kind of what fits best for the unit.
Okay.
I would have a little concern about, you know, if you draw an elk tag in the Book Cliffs, are we adding how many more of these spot and stock bear hunters could be colliding with somebody's drawed a tag?
So the Book Cliffs isn't one that, other than the roadless area, the Book Cliffs doesn't have won't have one.
Another question by the rack? Daniel?
A rigging question. So, a little clarification on the rigging rule change or the recommendation. Enforceability on that, is that going to be up to a discretion of a law enforcement officer, or as it's written, it's pretty vague, correct?
Yeah, like I mentioned, the key here, the current rule says that you can't pursue bears outside of legal hunting hours, and they're defined here the same. What we've added is this specific activity. The reason we're doing this is we're getting complaints, especially on the high interest units, that people feel like they're not all on the same page and they're not all playing by the same rules. And so this is an effort to set some ground rules for what you can do outside of legal hunting hours. And our feeling was that if you've got dogs rigged and you're trying to locate a bear, that you're in the act of pursuing. I guess that would be our stance here. So we're trying to set some ground rules so that everybody hunting is on the same page as to what's legal and what's not. But you're right. It would require an officer to make a case that they are doing it for the purpose of pursuing or locating a bear. you kind of still have to do that with the current rule. You'd still have to prove that they were pursuing bears outside of. You may want to. I don't know if we want to have. I won't put you on the spot, but I think it's always. You know, there always are cases that have to be made. And you have to think about how that's going to look when you get to through the process to the prosecutor and so forth.
So, as it's written right now, though, essentially. The law says we cannot be in pursuit 1.5 hour before daylight, correct?
Right.
So what happens in the case that I hunt out of a side-by-side and I want to go 8 miles from my camp because it's a lot of pressure around camp?
Right.
I can only fit so many dogs in the box versus dogs on the box, and I got to commingle.
Yeah.
What happens at that point? I mean, my intent may not be to hunt, but... It's that discretionary thing with me getting from point A to point B. And the other question is, what happens if I'm pulling out of my camp and I see someone else's dogs that got off the chain or something through the night, and I throw it on my box because I don't want to put it in, right? Because it could be a dog fighter or whatever.
I think in this case, the discretion would come about as to whether you're doing that for the purpose of locating a bear, or if you're just moving from one site to another, and our officers would have to make that call. Yeah.
Darren, help me understand the conflict there. Is it with hunters?
It's between
hunters type conflict, or is it
yes.
is it public to hunters conflict?
It's mostly most of what we've heard has been between houndsmen, and what we hear is that guys have dogs rigged all night long. They're driving the roads all night long, and when people arrive to hunt, they've got all these canyons locked up already. They've already located their bear, and they're sitting at the mouth of the canyon. Most of the time, they're waiting for legal hunting hours. Sometimes they're actually coming out of the canyons when people get there. And so those are the complaints we're receiving. So this is an effort to try and address some of those concerns. To a lesser extent, we do have other users that are complaining about dogs being out and barking all night long, and you know, they're camping and wondering why people are running around. So those are the concerns we've heard, and this is an effort to try and address that.
Not sure whatever happened to just letting the air out of their tires type thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's always that.
Right. Any other questions by the rack? All right, question by the public. If you have a question, please step up the mic here and state your name and ask your question.
Jamie Reeve, my question is, what's your success rate on the book cliffs? You have 65, proposing an additional 9. So what's
yeah, it depends on the season. The spring and fall seasons are about 30-ish percent, right, Clint? The 3-year average. The archery hunt was about 17%. There were 7 tags, and we were taking about 1 bear on the archery only. So that comes out to about 17. Right around there. I think, what is it averaged all the way across, Clint? It's.
I didn't write down. I think it was.
We could figure it out. It's like less than 50.
Wildlife biologist, 44%, yeah. I think, across the board.
Sounds right.
44 total for all the tags?
Yeah, that number's for 3 years. We can find out what the annual success rate is, but we look at it on a 3-year. Okay, yeah. We'll get that for you.
Okay. Other questions while they're looking that up?
Boy, we had a good Christmas party. They fed us good lunch the other day while we're making conversation. I was a little worried we ate beef instead of grains and deer, but...
You didn't get any of the roadkill.
Any other questions while we're looking at that?
I missed that. Last week. Was it last week?
No, I think it was Tuesday.
You'll get the success if you want to ask that question, I can tell you tag-wise.
Rodney Smith, is this mic even working?
I know.
I don't
think it is. I can't get any closer than this. I can't make out with it. What was the tax issue in 2018 and how many people were successful in 2018 for spring and spot and stock and for the fall hunt for the book list?
So the tags, including the archery only, were 9 less than this year, but let me get the total for you. And then Clint's looking up success rates, so.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, we.
I just didn't have everything. I just didn't have them all added up. So it is right. 44% is the total harvest success in the book list if you combine all the hunts that we offer out there.
Is it 3 years or 2000?
That is the 3 years.
3 years.
Okay. And then we're looking at 55%, 52% in the summer, 41% in the fall. And again, that's three-year average. If you just want to look at last year, we've got about 33% success in the spring, 56% in the summer, and then that fall hunt, like we talked about before, is 14.
And then the permit numbers were 27 in the spring, 9 in the summer, 6 in the fall, and 7 archery only.
Oh, boy, summer was high.
Jamie or Eve again. I guess my question is, the reason for increasing 9 permits is to harvest more?
Yes.
You're wanting to harvest. Do you have an amount you're looking to harvest?
100%? Yeah. It'll be similar to the, you know, they're spread across the different hunts. The success rates have been fairly successful, so probably half of those 9 I would expect to be harvested. The way that the plan works, it goes back to that complicated slide with all the different season. But on the book cliffs, on a moderate unit, over the last 3 years, our objective for 5-year-old and older bears, male bears, has been above objective, which is the direction that we'd want to be. And the number of females in the harvest has been below. So they're both outside of objective, but they're both in the same direction. And so the plan requires a permit adjustment between 20 and 40%. So on the book cliffs, that'd be between 11 and 23 permits. So we took into account those archery tags that are going to become a little bit more successful. That there's 7 of those. So with those 7 and the 9 additional permits, that's 16. So it's kind of right in the middle of what the plan requires.
Can you clarify requirement versus recommended?
Yeah, the plan requires us to recommend somewhere between 20 and 40% when we have those conditions over the last 3 years. It can be modified by reproduction. That's one thing that we can take into account. You know, if we aren't seeing a birth pulse over the last 5 years, we can adjust that down. But the plan prescription is, in other words, there's opportunity to be had. We're killing plenty of older age class males. And that should reflect what's available in the population. We're not taking too many females, and so there's additional opportunity there. I'm on the book cliff specifically. We do have some concerns about big game and some impacts there from predation, and so that factors in as well.
I've got a question. How many bear do you figure you got out there?
Clint Sampson, wildlife biologist. Great question. Bears are extremely hard to model with their population. So basically, Darren understands this a lot better than me because he explains it to me every time I ask him that same question. But we basically try to work backwards with our harvest data that we get back. So in the book list, the male harvest, the percent of males in our harvest is 50%. And so that's basically telling us 50% of the bears we're killing in the book cliffs are males. And then the age is also over 6 years old, which qualifies us for an increase. And then we also look at the percent of females in the harvest. Most guys are, you know, targeting specifically large males. So when we force, you know, their hand to harvest females or the opportunities to rise to harvest females, we take that into account as well. And so with that being, you know, a fairly low, you know, number in the 30 percentile, kind of shows us that we're increasing on our bears. And we do our best to call our females out there too and go to their den sites and monitor production that way. I'm trying to think back. I know 2 years ago we did have one female that was reproducing, and she did have two yearling cubs, and then she got harvested last year. And so she either got harvested or the collar stopped working. For some reason, we don't have her on. I should not have said that.
Yeah, we
put your foot in your mouth, huh?
But it's, yeah. I'm not 100% on if. I think the government trapper actually killed her
down in Willow Creek, from what I remember. But, yeah.
Yeah, because bears are so hard to count, we don't estimate a total number. We use these indexes, the number of adult males in the harvest and the number of females to try to figure out what's going on. If we've got plenty of females, or we're not harvesting very many, and we've got older age class males to do the breeding, then we figure we've got a stable population, and that's what we're managing for.
I've got one more question for Daniel. I know you're out there quite a bit. Can we give 9 more permits?
It's the worst bear season I've had out there. I'll put it at that.
Just like the elk hunting?
We are, it might be worth adding too, we are starting a predator study out on the book cliffs. So we're going to be collaring lions and some additional bears, and we're also coupling that with our deer and elk that are collared. Try and look at some of those dynamics, and you know, we're wondering how bears and lions interact at kill sites. We'll be looking at some of that too, just to try and learn a little bit more about how all those different critters interact.
Any other questions by the public? Not seeing any. We'll come back. If you have a comment, please fill out one of these cards. We're going to have a comment period next. So if you want to comment on this particular subject, there's some green cards just on the other side of that wall on out on the table. Please fill it out and get it up to us. We've only got one right now. So we'll go to the comments. Rodney, we'll let you come up. Yep.
I'm Rodney Smith. I'm with the Utah Houndsman Association. We had a long discussion, you know, with the proposal of the DWR. We were on the phone for several hours talking over everything. So we're in support of their proposals for the DWR, except for two. One being we're asking for a zero increase on the book cliffs, just because of talking to houndsmen. I personally went out there this year. I spent a week. I didn't catch one bear. Nothing happened for me. And like Dan said, you know, worst season he's ever had out there in the book cliffs. Al Meekum spent over a month out there. He caught 5 bears. So it's definitely struggling. We can all agree that, you know, everything's struggling out in the book cliffs right now. I mean, like you're concerned about all your friends with elk tags this year. It was not a very good year for a lot of tags who was 8 this year. So, and then also the second one is the rigging. We just feel like there's not enough there's just too much loophole in there that people are going to come up with everything in their hat. I had one of our houndsmen on our conference call said that, you know, we're just going to get a blue heeler and train him to rig bears, you know. So, I mean, also it goes back to, like Dan said, four-wheelers and side-by-sides. A lot of people just have, you know, they haul their dogs out in the dog box and they don't want to hunt out of their truck. So they just throw them in their side-by-sides. If they're in over a Monument and they want to hunt Billy Brown, that's a long drive, you know, and they want to get there and they know of a good bear that's over there. So we feel like that's not, we just feel like there's just too much leeway for people to come up, and so we're against the rigging rules just because, yeah, it's just a lot of, there's going to be a lot of conflict, and we already have conflicts with non-residents on the Book Cliffs. So, but yeah, that's what we come up with. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rodney. I don't have any other ones, so we'll close the comment period and bring it back to the rock for a discussion. Let's talk about them.
How's the bears in Hill Creek, Tim?
Waiting right there to ask.
You got to. She's not allowed to get up now, Tim.
Yeah. We was down there in the spring. We didn't see as many as we usually do. So I think.
One time. Yeah, one time.
Just want to make it for the record that all of the other racks, it's kind of nice that this is the last rack, because I can say all the other racks, they voted against the rigging, the new rigging law that DWR proposed. And then, as far as I'm aware, there was one other rack that voted an increase for the Book Cliffs, and that was two tags. I think and that was one rack. I believe the other racks did not vote for an increase on that south of the Book Cliffs.
Okay.
Thank you.
Jamie, have you got any other words to help us with Tim's question? Well, how the bear are out on that Hill Creek? Step up the mic if you would. we're recording it, so you got to get the minutes.
All right. So for the Hill Creek last year, we increased our permit numbers. The reason we did that is because we didn't have the amount of tribal members harvesting bears. It's more of a cultural thing on our side, so if we can get people out there that's willing to shoot bears, you know, I think that's why we increased our numbers. Prior to this year, you know, I haven't heard a whole lot back on the fall hunt, but prior to this year, we were seeing plenty of bears. My husband and I went out elk hunting, and we've seen three bears in one day, two bears in another day, all in different areas. So I think they're plentiful on our side.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I add to that? Where she turned around and was talking about culture, I think that's why a lot of the tribal members do not hunt them. It's because that animal means a lot to us, and we do ceremonies for him. So I know that there is a few of them that will hunt them, you know. And this fall, I don't think there was maybe but one or two taken. So.
Okay. Thank you, Tim.
Would it be possible for Darren DuBois to also say what happened at the other racks?
Yeah.
Because I think it's different than what was presented to us.
Yeah.
I can clarify that. So the southeastern rack was the only one that did vote different. They did vote for no increase on the Book Cliffs, but they did pass the rigging. That was the only difference.
So, yeah, Darren, make sure I get that in my mind. What did the other racks do as far as the hunts go?
So southeastern rack is the only of the other racks that did not change this
recommendation on rigging. Everyone else wanted to leave it as it is. So just as a point. And then on the...
Wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand it.
Yeah.
Leave it as is.
Southeastern...
They didn't pass your the proposal.
Right.
Okay.
Southeastern left it... Everybody changed it back to the way it was except Southeastern, and they had a split vote, and it didn't pass. So they're keeping this recommendation. On the Book Cliffs, yeah, Northern voted to only increase it by 2. Southern voted to increase by 0, and the other two RACs left it as per our recommendation. So it's 2.
It's kind of split there.
Yeah.
Thank you. Discussion, some more comments.
Yeah, I'll get them out. Everybody knew it was coming, so. So the current concerns we have is in 2015, we went to this more liberal strategy in harvest. We talk about a three-year management plan, but we've increased these permits. Excuse me, we have not increased these permits in the Book Cliffs over that three-year period. The parameters did allow, but science said that really it's not the case. We shouldn't, and we appreciate that. But what we did see that first year is, again, a low cub reproduction that year. We had our highest sow harvest of over 40% that year. And what we see now in that effect, which would be those mature cubs that would have been born the next year and brought to fruition, are not there. And so with the drought that we had, hunting's difficult. Hunting's hunting. You're not guaranteed to go out and find a bear every time you go. I'm helping the division with this collaring of the cougars. Oh, heck, slam dunk, we'll get 10 females. We have not caught one female yet. So hunting's hunting. Right, each year dictates certain circumstance, but with the drought that we've seen and the conditions we ran the bears and caught the bears in all honesty, it's not a cop-out, it's not keep it out of my backyard thing. I hear those comments thrown out a lot, and that's not the case because each unit's different. They all have different situations to deal with, habitat, access, pressure, and those type of things, and truly, we're concerned not only that there's not going to be a cub production this year, the sows aren't going to be healthy enough to sustain that. If she does have yearlings this year, she's going to have a hard time keeping them through the winter if they're still nursing. We're afraid that there's going to be a lot of bears that don't come back out of the ground this spring. With the three-year management, we're not against that. However, we've been, over the last 3 years of data that's online, we've been 32% sow harvest. And we're afraid if we continue that trend, that sow harvest is going to start to increase. The thing is it's based off of what is harvested, not how many is harvested. So it can be a small number, and your percentages, right, skew accordingly. To increase the permits, we're moving 7 out of the archery season already. 7 of those was getting one field a year. So essentially we're putting 16 out that if we approve this as presented, that we would kill a 40% of that on average, 44%. And that's that many more bears expected to be harvested when we're already seeing the issues. Checked by law enforcement out there, seeing how everything's going, take our feedback, and actually got the same feedback from them that everyone they've checked, it's not been good. So I highly recommend that we do not increase permits on a three-year management strategy. Now, the caveats of, well, we can come back and change this, or we can come back and do that if it's drastic. It's going to take something drastic to get that reaction. A steady decline is not going to achieve that. The other concern is the rigging. at the times. The biggest concern locally with the houndsmen and the issues they've got is the turning out early. If somebody wants to go out and drive around at 2 o'clock in the morning, knock yourselves out. I'm going to go ahead and wait for daylight, get a little bit more beauty sleep because y'all know I need it. But so that rigging brings up a lot of issues. Right now, we're currently allowed to hunt raccoons 24 hours a day. There's a lot of coons in areas where there's bears around the state. And what's my intent? It may be spring bear season, but I could be trying to rig coons and hunt coons. We're allowed to hunt coyotes 24 hours. We can use dogs to do that as well. So there's a lot of issues and a lot of legal issues that arise from that new rule, which is why heavily across the state they've decided to stay away from that. The easiest rule to enforce is turning out before legal light. It's just like hearing a gunshot. You can't shoot half hour before daylight. You can't turn out half hour before daylight. Prior to that 30 minutes before daylight. So those are the concerns that are brought out. There's a lot of good changes that come. We're not opposed to the additional permits, the additional opportunity, and that's why we've focused so much on where the true issues are and address all the attention to those.
I got a question for you, Daniel. If in fact the Wildlife Board approved the presentation like it's been presented for as far as the book list goes, with the archery tags being moved and the total of 9 new tags, how many bear do you think we're talking about getting harvested?
If we
talking 50%, we talking eight additional bear. What are you thinking?
Statistically, off of the historical data, yes, that's correct. So we're looking at 8 additional bear based off of those 16, because we're going to include those 7 that have a very low success rate. And then that initial year with a low to no fawn reproduction from the conditions of the bears that we've seen and what's in the den this winter, we won't know till March, April, but historically it's going to be low, and those 8 bears could very well be all sows. And just from the effects from 2015 when we had that large sow harvest, we're seeing that effect today, which is when we would see it.
And Darren, if I'm not mistaken, whatever the Wildlife Board does this year, we're going to do it for the next 3 years. I mean, that's so, yeah. Yeah, he shook his head yes, so, all right.
I guess I'd like to comment. I think I agree with what I'm hearing that the bears, but we're still back to the big picture of too many mouths to feed on the book cliffs. And we had the deer discussion. We had the elk discussion. We had the lion debate. And it's all related to something's got to give. And we need to decide if without everything give like we're doing now, or I agree, the bears are probably hurting. This will probably knock the bear back a little bit. But if we do that, I would assume we'd hope that there would be positive effects elsewhere. I know we don't manage deer. We don't manage bears based on the deer herd like we do the lions, but it's the same issue, isn't it? In reality, they still eat the fawns and calves. And so we just need to decide as a board whether we're just going to have everything suffer out there or if something's got to take a hit, because I don't think we can maintain all the species. I know Richie's working hard, and if we get rid of the cattle, the feral cattle and horses, that would really make our job easier. But that's the way I see it. I agree with what I'm hearing, but back to the where do we give?
You know, I'd like to agree with that. You know, I don't like that rigging rule. I think it's going to be quite controversial there. But I think with the, it's just like the deer, the elk, the lion, everything's got to give. I think we need to, take care of our stuff. You know, if they're hurting out there, we need to cut back. You know, we need to cut the numbers down. We need to cut the, you know, just like we're doing, you know, in the drought situation with the deer and the elk. And if we're trying to increase our herds, I think it all needs to be, you know, hit a little bit.
So if I can speak to that, I've done a little bit of homework this last little while. I asked Dax a question, but I'm not going to clarify that because I'd really look silly. But looked up all the herd data, and I actually spent some time, graphed it, trended it, see where we're at. The elk herd's at an all-time high in the Book Cliffs, as a matter of fact. The deer herd, there's cyclical issues with the deer herd that doesn't come back from drought seasons that aren't impacted. In that trend, I also trended the total harvest of bears each year, total harvest of cougars each year. And there's not that much of a correlation. And that was true graph data that come off of the website out of their harvest data for every species. Can't use a thumb drive to put it up there for everybody to see, but I would ask you to take my word for it that the correlations are there. The perception of cougars, bears, predators affecting the herds is absolutely 100% correct. But this is a 3-year change on a 1-year drought. And that's what I'd ask everybody to consider.
Other comments?
I guess I have the same question is, I mean, we don't know exactly what the drought is going to look like as far as what the numbers. It's going to hurt everything. I think there's just no doubt about it. I think the numbers are going to be down on everything across the board.
Except the whole.
As far as reproduction rate and those kind of things, but
you sell tags on that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we increase the if we don't increase the bear tags, do we reduce? I guess if we increase the bear number tags, do we decrease the number of elk and deer tags? You know what I mean? To try to. Because you can't talk about predators without the effect and what that management without talking about the prey species and that effect on them. So I don't know where everything's going to take a hit. It's a hard management year. I mean, I don't know. Do you make drastic changes after a year like this? I'm not real sure. But, yeah, I think you're going to see a pretty big decline in numbers and reproduction rate the next few years probably. And hopefully that will recover. But if we're going to increase bear tags, I don't know. If we don't increase bear tags, do we pull back a little bit on the elk and deer tags to try to compensate that? Because so you're going to kill maybe an additional 24 bear over the next 3 years. I don't know what, you know, biologists could tell you better what the effect of those 24 bears can have on the prey species. If they think that's something good to do on a year like this because everything's going to suffer, maybe that's the thing to do. I don't know. It's a hard management year. I mean, it is really hard to manage on this year. I know the elk hunters were disappointed. The bear hunters was disappointed. I think they're going to see that disappointment maybe for the next few years. And that is if the drought changes. If the drought don't change, there's going to be a lot of years of disappointment. And that's just the way it is. I don't think the numbers, as far as for this year, because of the drought, the numbers are probably not much different this year as far as actually population. It's there's not water where there used to be water. They've changed where they're at, basically. I've seen it on Blue Mountain big time. I mean, where we usually seen a lot of elk and big elk, they just wasn't there. We had to go different places to see them. They're there, but they're not where they usually are. And that's going to persist if the drought don't change.
And Just to make a clarification, the opposition is on the 9 permits additional. There's still 7 permits that's being restructured that's going to increase the bear harvest, and that's not being opposed. When the committee met and talked about and had the discussion, let me rephrase this, the discussion group, not the committee, that was agreed upon knowing that those permits were going to be dispersed through those higher success hunts, knowing that's going to drive the harvest up without any addition. And so the opposition comes from that addition on top of that. So just to clarify that there will be an increase even if the 9 permits aren't added.
I got a question, Mr. Chair. How long does it take a bear to have cubs, and how many times in a cycle? I know it's four to four and a half to have cubs, but how much, you know, how many years does it take to have another litter of cubs?
She'll have one every third year after that.
That's a long time. That's an awful long time. You know, so me, if we're going to go and take more than we're going to take, it's going to take a life cycle for them to get built back up. And like Richie was saying about, we didn't take anything from the deer or the elk. So, matter of fact, we left everything as is.
Today, what I'd like to do, I think we'll divide this into two different topics. Let's concentrate right now on the numbers of permits, and then after we hash that one out, let's come back and discuss the rigging and hash that out. It looks like those are the two topics that we need to hit right now. So let's just kind of concentrate on the numbers. I know we've been talking numbers just now, so let's keep that topic up, and then we'll come back and hit the rigging afterwards.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair, that we do not increase the 9 permits on the Book Cliffs for the next 3 years.
Motion was made by Daniel Davis that we do not increase the tags in the Book Cliffs as part of this proposal. Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Tim Ignacio, second that. Further discussion? Not seeing any discussion, we'll call for motion. All those in favor? 1, 2. 2 in favor. Those opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What do you think, Rebecca?
I don't know what to do.
You gotta vote. Unless there's a reason that you need to abstain because you're tied to the issue too close.
Opposed.
You're opposed. Okay, so we've got two in favor, 6 opposed. All right, so that motion failed. So we go back to the numbers. Is there another motion we want to make on that particular thing?
Can I ask Darren a quick? You said you were in the mid-range of the bear management plan with the recommendation. What would be the minimum number that would fit the 11. Bear plan?
11 would be the minimum. That'd be a 20% increase.
So what would be the increase on a minimum?
11. Additional.
No, that'd be the max.
Are you recommending 9
yeah.
instead of the minimum?
Oh, I thought he said he was recommending. I thought he said we were in the middle.
Oh, sorry. The reason I said that is this point that we're making about those 7 archery-only tags. That those were reabsorbed into more successful hunts, so we kind of counted those.
You expect 2 or 3 extra
bears. We expect some extra bears, so we added an additional 9, and that puts us within, that, you know, call that 16 permits. It's probably more like 14 if you consider the success rate on those archery mm-hmm. tags, and that puts us, you know, right where we need to be on the plan. Guidelines.
You are at the minimum of the range.
Yeah, we're a little above. I mean, 11 would be the bottom of what the plan requires.
And we think we're at 12 or
probably at 14 or 16, yeah. Call it 16. We'll just add them all together.
16?
Yeah.
And mind you, that it's a recommended plan. It's not a requirement. They're not required to increase or decrease permits.
We're required to make recommendations to the approved plans. So we're legally obligated to make a recommendation to the plans that have been approved through the public process. But we do take other extenuating circumstances into consideration, and that's why we didn't recommend the minimum of 11 that's in the approved plan. We recommended less than that because we realized there's other circumstances.
That was Dax, by the way. Next time we're going to ask him to step up the mic. Thank you.
I got a question for Dax while we're at it. Where are we objective on deer and elk in the Book Cliffs as it maybe pertains to predators and bear?
Under on both, at about half of the deer objective. Around elk, our objective is 7,500 elk, around 6,000. Is that right?
So if you was to wing a number at us, what would be the bear damage as far as, is it 10% likely that it affects that objective? Or would you say it's higher than that? Low, you know, could you throw a number?
I can't throw a number out. That's part of the reason why we're starting this collar study. Collars on bears, collars on lions, and they're predators. Predator management is closely related and tied to prey species management. But I don't know that it's so noisy. There's so many moving parts in the system. I don't know that I can put a number on that. I'm hoping we can get closer to that with some of the things we're looking at with the GPS collars, but right now I can't put a number on it.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Dax.
I know a cougar kills more than a bear does.
Other comments? Still talking about the numbers. Does anybody want to make an addition, another motion?
I would like to make a motion to accept the numbers as proposed by the DWR.
I'll second it.
Motion was made by Natasha Haddon that we would accept the presentation as presented, seconded by Brad Horrocks. Additional comments?
That would be the numbers.
That would just be the numbers. The numbers as presented. You got it. Additional comments or concerns? If you want to make an amendment, now would be the time, but... Not seeing any. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 in favor, opposed. 1, 2, 3. Well, that passed.
This is already a
tree. Okay, let's talk about the rigging now. I don't like it. I don't like this. Just to be honest with you, I think it's got too much hair on it personally for my feel. But that's why I was curious as to if it was a public head issues or just the houndsmen themselves between them. But and I can understand it would bother me if somebody had every place locked up that in the morning too. But they better have a lot of dogs, I guess.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
That we accept the rules the division has presented without including the rigging rule.
Okay, so you're making a motion to support the rest of the presentation the division has without the rigging rule.
Correct.
All right, that Daniel Davis made that motion.
Including on the count or something, or what are we doing there?
The count pass? The
Yes.
Yeah, the numbers.
Okay, clarify that, would you, Daniel, a little?
So they presented several other rules. So in my motion, I'm including everything else so we can do one more motion to try to finish this. And so the rules with adding the air bows, there were some clarification rules on designees for the control permits and those type of things. So my motion is to allow all those additional rules so we don't have to make another one because we did permit numbers. And so to accept all those remaining rules except for the rigging rule that they've proposed.
We got a motion on the table. Do I have a second?
I would second that motion.
Seconded by Brett Prevedel. Any other discussion? All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Thank you. Thank you. 8. Passed. 8 to unanimous.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question?
Please do.
So we've had a lot of talk lately, and I don't know who the right person is to answer this question or if it's out of place, but it seems to fit pretty tight in the topic tonight and last month, actually. We're taking a lot of pressure on predators, but what steps are being taken, it's still not very clear what we're doing about the horses and the cows, the habitat, sustainment, AUMs, the whole gamut. It seems like we're pointing the finger in specific direction without a consideration of everything else. So can anybody answer that?
Do you want me to address that?
Please.
Spent pretty much the entire day today with some DNR, DWR folks on this issue specifically. And I wish Jamie would have stayed because she's involved as well. But Tim can kind of be aware, I'm sure he's aware. There's more attorneys involved in this deal than anything I've ever seen, I think. It looks really good, very positive about what we're going to be able to do, but you're dealing with so many different agencies, with so many different jurisdictions, and so there's a lot of T's that have to be crossed and I's dotted. It's going to happen. There's going to be a removal of feral horses and cattle, maybe not as quick as we'd like, definitely not as quick as I would like. And I've instigated it. I've opened a huge can of worms, but it's a good one. And it will take place. It's a possibility we may start in February. We're going to start kind of small. The consensus is we're going to get sued. That's the consensus. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think we're going to get sued, but that's kind of the consensus. But that doesn't mean we can't do it. We have to do it. We're going to start kind of small. We're going to start kind of here south of Vernal and sweep west and southwest. We only have so much budget. So the state legislature has appropriated some money, but that's only so much money. And we're going to average about probably around a $400 per head cost of gather. It primarily is going to be conducted by helicopter. That's the most efficient and effective way to do it. We have gathered some horseback off the bird refuge in cooperation with the tribal family. We can do that, but it's a slow process and it can mean broken bones because my family's had broken bones doing that. And so don't think that, yeah, we are definitely trying. We see the huge pressure that's creating on habitat. And that's the thing, it's easy, but what we're not going to accept is it's easy for the agencies, the easiest thing to do is for agencies to
pull
back on the permitted cattle, because they can do that really quick and say, you guys can't take out this many cattle. But the problem is the number of cattle being ran out there hasn't changed, and we can manage that quickly. The problem is we've got an introduction of a species that doesn't belong. It shouldn't be there. And so this time we're not going to take the approach, let's just hit the easiest target. We're going to take the approach, we're going to eliminate what shouldn't be there. It hasn't, you know. And so that's what we're doing. But as far as specifics, I'm not going to get into that because we don't have all night. But it is a huge effort. We've had meetings every week now for a while.
So if funding's an issue, will they accept outside source funding?
We can to an extent, and it depends on, I mean, yeah, the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife or whatever could help with that funding, but it's all got to be channeled the right way through the right legal process. It's not as easy as just saying the sportsmen are going to put up $100,000 and we can get a helicopter out here tomorrow. It just doesn't happen that way. I will tell you, and I won't get into specifics, but over the last 2 years, the projects I've been involved with, we've removed now well over 200 horses already. That was through a different channel, a different way, right. But that's only 200 horses over the course of 2 years. I want to take 200 to 500 off in 2 weeks. And we can do that with a helicopter. The way we've been doing it, we've been making progress, and we've been removing them, but it's really slow.
Mr. Daniel? I know a few, I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago, Sportsman's and Fish and Wildlife put up some money for the North Unit, and they ran them that way. And they took probably 200 to 300 head of horses off from the North Unit, because those horses was going up on the Baldies and all up through there. And I know they're still rounding horses up, but where Hill Creek has been turned into a wilderness unit, the brand inspectors, they won't jump on it. So Jamie that was sitting there, she's had, I know she's had some directives thrown at her. That's why Richie said it would be nice if she could have sat there and answered, you know. But I know for a fact that I know Dax was part of that Sportsman's of Fish and Wildlife, and we got that rolling on that North Unit. So if you was willing to have somebody help throw in to help get this ball rolling, maybe Dax could lead you in the right direction.
And Daniel, so the tribe's going to be an integral part in solving this issue. And so we've got them, I mean, they're participating in what we're doing as far as support and whatnot. What the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife wanted to do with the tribe or something like that, that would be up to them. Because the more horses, the tribe wants to get rid of horses, correct, Tim?
Right.
Big time. So,
'cause I know we have a wild horse initiative, but I know she was saying something about 300 head, and I said no. I said 50 for the west side and 50 on the east side. That would be more than enough, and it has to stay at that.
So this private entities could help fund. Actually, they could make a deal with the tribe to help fund the removal of horses on the tribe. And that would actually be pretty easy, and that would help a lot. I know the tribe's willing to do that, and the more horses we start eliminating there, takes pressure off of everything else. So there's a good opportunity for some private funding there. We talked about it today, actually.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a comment on from the county and the state level. The Division of Natural Resources is, correct me if I'm right, Richie, they got some money allocated for this. Is that how it's funneled down through? But,
yes.
But it's a joint effort. Quite frankly, if it wasn't for Richie, this would not be happening. And it's probably one of the biggest benefit that we have seen around here for years. If this goes through with everything that he's planned, and I'd like to just people need to be aware that Richie, we appreciate you, and I see it on the county level and on the state level, and listening what this project is and what's going to take place, it's going to be tremendous benefit.
Well, thank you. And the thing is, you got to understand, this has gone all the way up to the state legislature, and now it's coming all the way back down to the ground. Okay, so yeah, this process started a long time ago with the state legislature and Scott Chu to get this funding, and so I'm not a patient person, but we got to have a little more, unfortunately.
All right, thank you, Richard. Really appreciate that that update and
thank you.
All your support there. All right, we'll jump to the next topic. Item number six on our program, Bronghorn unit plans, and I guess Dax, you're going to be our presenter tonight. Is that right?
Yeah, Kent Hersey's out on some capture project work, and so I'll be presenting these plans. I guess I'd just mention too, in addition to the tremendous effort that's being undertaken with regard to stray horses, there's also the division was directed by the Wildlife Board at the very end of the board meeting, the last board meeting, to sit down and look at just what's going on with habitat in the Book Cliffs, even beyond the horse issue, what's going on with wildlife numbers, with range conditions, with drought, with livestock, with, and so, this is definitely probably the biggest part of what we're doing there, but I think there'll be some other efforts as well, and some other probably some meetings and looking at some stuff, because we recognize it's a big issue, it's a complicated issue, and there's a lot going on with regard to what's happening in the Book Cliffs. So other than that, I guess we'll jump into the 2018 Utah Pronghorn unit plans. So I'm not quite as tall as Darren, so I got to put it down a little bit. The statewide Pronghorn plan was presented and approved by the Wildlife Board last fall. The unit plans were revised in accordance with that new with the statewide plan, and we in the future won't be bringing unit plans around through the public process unless we're proposing a major boundary change, a change in the population objectives, or we're proposing a new unit. At that point, we'd bring a new unit plan. Otherwise, any other minor changes to the unit plans would just be approved by the division director. So from the statewide plan, some of the new directives in the statewide plan was to manage all the different units, subunits, for a three-year average of harvested animals between 2 and 3 years old, but while also taking trends into account, and to use archery and muzzleloader hunts to distribute hunters and provide additional hunting opportunity. The population management goal for the statewide plan, for these unit plans, would be to manage the population objectives to the carrying capacity of the unit of the habitat, and then the statewide population objective for Pronghorn would be the sum of the unit plans for the state. Here's a graph showing the population objective based on the objectives in these unit plans that we're presenting today, and then a current population estimate for the state that shows where that is in relation. The green line there at the top would be the objective. If all the units were at objective, it'd be 21,555, a little bit under that right now, based on current population estimates. So these are the next five slides are the different regions, the Pronghorn units in those regions, what the objectives are, and what the current population estimates are. So here you see central region, objective 2,200, current estimate is 1,000. Northeastern region here in our region, the objective 4,275, we're sitting at 3,470 right now. Northern region, see they're pretty close, within about 400 of their objective in the northern region. Southeastern region, objective of 4,000, sitting at 3,665. There's a southern plateau unit, Parker Mountains are our big ones, and Southwest Desert. So those are the regional estimates. We also have in the plan, there were some pronghorn transplant sites. We're proposing a few additional sites on the North Slope unit in our region. Some of our better pronghorn habitat in this region is the stuff up close to Wyoming. Surprise, surprise, Wyoming is great antelope habitat. And so Amy Vandevoort, our biologist there on the North Slope, these are the sites: Antelope Flat, Bear Top, Clay Basin, Hunter Basin, Death Valley, and Goslin Mountain. So if approved, we would amend that table in the statewide plan to include these additional sites there on the North Slope unit.
We're continuing a lot of work through the Watershed Restoration Initiative and cooperative work with sportsmen and other agencies to continue to make sure we have good distribution of water across the landscape. A lot of guzzler projects going on, a lot of vegetation treatments that benefit pronghorn. In this region, we benefit from a lot of mitigation projects related to disturbance from oil and gas development to help do habitat work specific to pronghorn. And also in some parts of the state, there's as part of our migration initiative, identifying migration routes and corridors and looking at those things that affect pronghorn's ability to move. And that's it for the unit pronghorn management plans.
Thank you, Dex. I don't know if you can answer this. I guess I got one question from the data I looked in the presentation. Is in 2006 the population in the Buck Cliff Cisco unit doubled? Why? It went from shows 366 to 660 or 644, so it doubled in 1 year.
You know, I talked with Guy Wallace today on the phone, the wildlife manager in southeastern region, and he did tell me that he thinks there was some movement going on, some migration of animals that potentially happened during that time frame. But I don't know all the details specifically to that.
I can vouch for that. There's nothing in ORA.
This is the Cisco, right?
So yeah, the Cisco unit. Yeah, the Cisco unit, clear on the other side of the Buck Cliffs.
Yeah, clear on the south side down by I-70.
Yeah, I mean, then that was a counted one. That was the estimate. That was the actual counted was doubled. I just thought that was kind of a
anomaly there. Well, you got Buffalo there. Clear down into Moab.
Other questions by the rack?
Dax, I had a call this morning on the Cisco unit again. Is there a proposed increase on the Cisco unit?
Yeah, so I talked with Guy a little bit about that. And so in state code, the division was directed to write management plans to set population objectives for deer and elk. And we've done that for years. And in the past, we've had kind of informal pronghorn management plans that were basically internal documents. They didn't go through the rack and board process for pronghorn until right now. This is the first time we're proposing a population objective for these units that's gone through the public process. Some of those, I talked with Guy Wallace specifically about the Cisco unit, and in the past, Guy said there weren't a lot of pronghorn there, and when they set the objective, quote unquote, not technically an objective, but basically a target in this internal document, it wasn't something that went through the public process. Guy told me, to be honest, we basically just threw a number in there. We didn't really do a forage analysis or anything like that. He said, over time we saw numbers increase on that unit. We think there were some in-migrations of pronghorn that came into that unit. And when we redid the statewide plan, they went back and did actually, a technical analysis, looked at the forage to come up with an objective that was more meaningful. And that's where they came up with the 700 objective. And so I'm assuming there was probably some discussion about the old targets that used to exist before we had approved unit plans that went through the public process. And so I think that's maybe where the questions came up.
Hey, do we know what the population is now on that unit, Cisco?
Let's go back here. So looks like about 900 pronghorn.
Could you go back to that, the Bonanza, what the Bonanza South Slope, is that what they...
One too many.
Oh, sorry. Getting ahead of myself there.
So from what the estimate is now to what your objective is really not different?
I'm sorry, Richie. I was breezing past what you were asking about the Cisco, and then Commissioner Orr was asking about the South Slope Bonanza. We'll take you in the order you asked if we want to go back to the let's see, which way do I need to go here? To the Cisco, and then we can talk the Bonanzas. And I don't know all the details on the Cisco, but that was the conversation I had this morning with Guy Wallace, the manager from Southeastern Region.
Okay, so they think their population now is about 900.
Yes.
Because the call I got this morning, they thought the population was about 300, and so they were afraid of the objective going up to 900.
Maybe the South Cisco? Not the South Cisco?
Oh, maybe that's the South. Oh, yes, the South Cisco. Sorry.
South.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. Okay. So that's the one they were talking about.
All
right. There.
I'm confused. I'm not real familiar with those pronghorn units down there. So.
Okay. So that's the one they're worried about.
Objective is 700. Their estimate, current estimate is 375.
Right.
The 700 objective is based on forage analysis that they did.
Okay. That's the one they were talking about. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So. See, we need to go this way. Okay, Northeastern. Commissioner Horrocks, you had a question about the South Slope Diamond Bonanza unit?
Comment. Spent a little time out there last year and this year, and I hate to make it in a public meeting, but the good days are now with the antelope hunting out there. I mean, this is unreal for our area. I mean, it's kind of hard to give up your deer points to put in for a bonanza antelope tag, but it is tremendous.
We've seen in the last 3 or 4 years really good growth in our pronghorn populations here in the region. Unfortunately, after this year, I don't know. I think we'll probably take a little dip. I talked with Amy, the biologist for the bonanza unit, and she's a little concerned just with forage availability out there. She said there's not much to eat. You know, the horses are eating it all, I guess.
Yeah.
But when we had a lot of conflicts this year because we had drought conditions out on the range. We had a lot of pronghorn in fields. You know, I can't blame the pronghorn. You look out there on the desert and then you look at an irrigated, fertilized hay field. We removed a lot of pronghorn. We issued a lot of mitigation permits and vouchers to private landowners this year. But you're right. It's a great time to be hunting pronghorn. We'll just cross our fingers and see how long it lasts.
Oh, yeah.
I hope it rains.
If you like to go look at nice, good antelope, you're not going to find any better that's going on out there, you know, right now.
That's good to know.
No, it's not. Shouldn't have told you.
Competition.
All right. Other questions by the rack?
Is it proposed on the South Cisco to get up to objective that there be an introduction or just let?
I don't know. I'd have to look at the – I don't know that there's any plan
naturally.
To do that, but I'd have to look at that table in the plan to see if there's if there are any introduction sites there on the South Cisco, but I don't know.
Okay.
Other questions? Questions by the public? JC? All right. I don't have any comment cards on this one, so I guess we'll just jump right to the discussion. Discussion on the pronghorn item. Anybody have any?
One of my concerns on the South Cisco with the individual I talked to this morning is that some of the ranchers took a zero use on that range this year because of the conditions. And so I don't really want to see a double increase, even though they do share some habitat, some forage, antelope and cattle and sheep do. They don't share all forage, but they do cross over some. I guess I would like to see on that unit maybe not a double increase in objective number, maybe a smaller increase in objective number there, at least until we hopefully pull out of this drought.
How long would it take to get to that objective? 4 or 5 years?
Pronghorn can grow fast when conditions are good. They can grow really fast. We've seen that over the years down on Parker Mountain, that plateau unit, where sometimes just in a period of a couple of years, numbers can really... Really, 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 really increase quickly. So it depends on conditions, but you know, if you had really good conditions, you had great range conditions. I mean, it could happen quick within just a few short years. We should have Darren talk to this. I know he had a lot of fun managing pronghorn in Rich County when they really exploded on him.
So. Yeah, I think typically they have twins, if I remember right.
If conditions are good, they can grow really fast.
Dax, on the management plan, it's been under objective for like 10 years, right? We were trying to get to 21,000, it's at 17,000. Is that something that you'll lower the objective, or why haven't we not been able to obtain why we're 4,000 short?
I think a lot of times that has to do with, you know, drought cycles, and a lot of times those objectives are set based on looking at the availability, maybe looking at an average of, you know, good years and bad years. And I think seems like there's always at least somewhere in the state that maybe isn't having a good year. You have something happen. The division tries to manage towards those objectives, but sometimes on units where you're under objective, you might still have some doe hunts, even if they're just, you know, landowner doe hunts, because you get disproportionate use on private lands, on agricultural lands. So there's different obstacles that sometimes come up to prevent you from managing to the objective.
Thank you.
Other discussion? If I don't hear one, we'll entertain a motion. Anybody want to make a motion on this particular topic?
I'll make a motion that we propose, or we support the plan as presented by DWR, with the exception of the South Cisco. And instead of increasing that objective number by double the current number, we only increase that objective number by 100 of their current population. So the objective number would be 475 instead of 700. The information I just read stated that the population has ranged between 535, so that would still increase and be within that range. So that's my motion.
Tanya, did you get that motion to approve the plan as presented, with the exception of the LaSalle South Cisco, that it be limited to
475.
Okay. Do I have a second on that motion?
How about a friendly amendment? Let's go 575.
Okay.
Okay, the motion was amended to 575, which would be a 200 animal increase. We have a second on that.
I'll second that.
Daniel Davis made that second. I failed to mention that Brad Horrocks, that was the one that amended the motion. I know you did. All right. Any discussion? All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Unanimous. Thank you. All right. I guess, Dax, are you doubling for Kent on the moose plan?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. So the 2018 moose unit plans, similar story. Took a statewide, revised statewide moose plan through the Wildlife Board fall of 2017, and now we've revised the unit plans to in accordance with that new statewide plan. Again, we wouldn't bring these unit plans back out through the public process unless we were making a major boundary change, changing the population objective, or proposing a new unit plan. Otherwise, the minor changes would be approved by the division director. There are 10 unit plans being presented. They're there. You can see them there on the map, and there's a list of those unit plans. From the statewide plan, one of the objectives was to increase hunting opportunity while still maintaining a quality hunting experience. And we'll be trying to manage for a three-year average age of harvested bulls of between 3 3/4 and 4 1/4 on these units. So between 3.375 and 4.25-year-old bulls would be managing for. And we would also use subunits to maximize hunter opportunity and distribute hunters where appropriate. The unit population objectives and estimates are here in this table. Again, a moose is one of those species that the division has not been directed in code to come up with population objectives for moose, but only deer and elk, but we think it's a good idea, and so we're proposing doing that. And here are the objectives and the estimates. from across the state. Statewide objective, 3,400. Statewide estimate, 2,570. Moose transplant sites are listed in the statewide plan. There are some proposed additional sites that would be added to the statewide plan if approved through the through this unit plan process. Those would be a few sites there on the Camas, and then some on the North Slope, Algren Creek, Dowd Mountain, Elk Park, Henry's Fork, Sheep Creek Lake, and Spirit Lake, and then on the South Slope, Charlie's Park, Lighty Peak, Long Peak Reservoir, that should be Long Park Reservoir, sorry, and Mosby Mountain. So if approved, we would add those sites to the table in the statewide plan. Some of our objectives include habitat improvement, mountain mahogany, and aspen riparian vegetation. A lot of these projects come through the Watershed Restoration Initiative and in cooperation with federal partners and sportsmen and other individuals. Our goal is to maintain moose populations that are at appropriate densities so that it's sustainable and we can maintain high quality habitat. And that's it for the unit moose plan presentation.
Thank you, Dex. Any questions by the RAC?
I have one, Dex. Last spring, I seem to remember we increased permit numbers on moose because we wanted to harvest them at a younger age. And I thought we talked about managing them for a three-year-old because they were dying of what was, I guess, unknown causes, but it was called natural causes. I thought we lowered that last spring, even though we didn't have a management plan. I thought we targeted that age when we did the permits.
Yeah, I know we issued additional permits. I can't remember the exact details of the conversation, but I know
it was because the bulls were dying before we could harvest them. They weren't living to an old age.
You have a lot of disease issues and
right.
Nutritional shortage issues in moose.
And so that's my only question where this target's four-year-old. I thought we contradicted that last spring.
Some of this is based on analysis done by we had the folks Randy Larson and Brock doing an analysis. They looked at antler size and age and found that, you know, sometimes the common thought is that it's kind of a linear relationship, and the older these animals get, the bigger they get. And they found that it's not necessarily a linear relationship there. It's
same
more of an asymptote.
Same with antelope.
Yeah. You know, a lot of those animals, an antelope, by the time they're 2-3 years old, they're pretty much as big as they're ever going to be. And with moose, I think it was, you know, 3-4.
Clarified, antelope we went 3, moose we went 4.
Is that what it was?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I know when we did that increase was because they were getting overpopulated and starting to get the ticks or whatever it was, because when they were laying down on the presentation, they were leaving a lot of blood spots in the snow.
Yep, that's right. A lot of parasite problems, those winter tick loads. And you know, we've done some studies, some work in this region on the Wasatch and on the North Slope, and seen a lot of issues with moose.
What are we doing for our habitat in our area here? Is there places we need to really do more habitat, or are we done, or we get about our population is about as good as it's going to get, or what's the plans? I want more moose.
Well, I don't think you're alone in wanting more moose. We really are at kind of the southern fringe of what is, you know, moose habitat. We're kind of right on the margin where we're at. Moose are actually one species that, you know, the harsh winters that we worry about our deer in a harsh winter, a lot of times those are really good for moose, help with some of those parasite problems. Moose is a little bit tricky. A lot of our best moose habitat is higher elevation stuff, especially in the Uintas. A lot of our good moose habitat in wilderness, and you know, we've had pretty good success doing a lot of habitat work on winter ranges, you know, on lower elevation lands, BLM lands. It's a little harder in some of our higher elevation lands to get some of that habitat work done. I think over on the Wasatch Unit to the west of our region, it is in our region. The Dollar Ridge Fire burned through did some things that will be positive for moose, with getting some regeneration in some of that, you know, higher mountain browse community. we do have some issues with just finding the right tools to do habitat improvement for moose, and we don't have a ton of moose, and it is kind of difficult to specifically target projects for moose.
Other questions? No questions by the public. We'll move on to no comment cards. So we'll go straight to the discussion. Anybody have any heartburn with this one? I'm not seeing any. I'll call for a motion.
I'll make the motion that we accept the moose plan as presented, I guess.
That was Brad Horrocks made a motion to approve it as presented. Have a second?
I will second that motion.
Brett Previdell had a second. No further discussion. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Good job.
Unanimous. Nice job, Dax.
You Salt Lake a few things.
You should have had me present the bear stuff.
Remember that next year, guys.
We'd still be working on it.
All right, next we're going to talk about the CHA rule amendments.
All right. Avery Cook, Upland Game Project Leader from Salt Lake, here to talk about some proposed amendments to the commercial hunting area rule. So I can start with just a brief background on commercial hunting areas in the state. So CHAs are areas of private land where pen-reared game birds are released for hunting purposes. These CHAs provide about 19,000 hunter days in addition to the hunting that's done on the wild populations within the state. We've currently got 76 registered CHAs in the state, and these CHAs are regulated by the division due to impacts on wildlife. So there's potential disturbance of wintering and breeding wildlife, both other game birds and non-game species. There's potential disease transmission from the pen-reared birds, both to wildlife populations and to the poultry industry within the state. And there's potential for lethal take of other game birds within the state that resemble, especially the hen pheasants look a lot like some of the hen grouse species we've got. CHAs can be permitted to release pheasant, chuckers, and quail. We've got about 90,000 pheasants released, 16,000 chuckers, and 2,000 quail released each year. So some of the proposed changes are primarily to streamline the administrative process for commercial hunting areas, to put less of a burden on the operators who are turning in applications and annual reports, and also less effort on the part of the DWR to process those annual reports and applications so we can turn them around a little quicker. So primarily we'll be proposing some changes to eliminate redundant applications, to allow digital mapping, simplify reporting, update some of the boundary marking requirements, some small changes to clarify rule language, and also a couple of additional disease testing requirements. So for the updated map requirements, currently the rule requests that operators turn in both a plat map and a 7.5 minute USGS topo map. We're proposing that to allow just for digital mapping so that operator could turn in a digital file or draw it on our website, and also requiring boundary verification for renewal applications. As it currently stands, if you turn in a renewal application, you don't have to turn in a map. We're just looking at changing that, where we could send the operator a copy of what we got for the renewal application, then they just verify that that matches what's on the ground. Also update acreage requirements. Currently, commercial hunting area is limited to 1,920 acres or three sections. Looking at expanding that to 5,760 acres or nine sections. And the logic behind that is we've got a number of CHAs in the state that hit up against that acreage cap, and as a result, they're just turning in two, three, four applications for what's effectively operating as a single CHA. So this proposed change would just simplify that, where they could turn in a single application for what is in effect and in operation a single CHA, and then just looking at retaining that 180-acre minimum size. As far as boundary markings, we've had some comments that the signage interval can be a little excessive, so we're just proposing to change it from every 300 feet to every 300 yards for posting requirements, and that matches up with the CWM rule as well. So get a little more consistency between rules too. That currently the rule requires a CHA to be a contiguous tract of land. We're proposing to change that, where CHA would not be required to be a contiguous tract. Some of this comes from operators having properties that are either section corners or divided by a road, so they're having to turn in multiple applications for, again, what is operated as a single CHA. And the change we're proposing would just have all the pieces of a CHA have to fit within a 10-mile diameter circle. And there's just some examples of how that could play out along the bottom there. So the leftmost one is just one big block up against the acreage cap. That would obviously fit in within the circle. And then the next one over to the right would be, you could have a CHA that was broken up amongst blocks. You'd still be subject to that minimum 180-acre size. But aside from that, you could have multiple parcels within one CHA as long as it fit within that 10-mile diameter circle. If two parcels didn't fit within the 10-mile diameter circle, like that third example, then it would still be subject to two separate applications. And then that fourth example is an example from one of the CHAs in the state that is currently having to turn in three applications. They just have to turn in one. In the current rule, there's a provision for a season extension, and there's some caveats to that where it can't be interfering with native wildlife in the state. Basically never able to actually approve that season extension, so we're proposing to remove it from the rule so we're not wasting operators' time applying for something that we can't approve. As far as application dates, currently we've got a single application period. We like to that we just have rolling applications, so a new operator could turn in an application any time of year instead of having to wait till just before the season to know if their CHA is approved or not. In the current rule, there's a provision where if the commercial hunting area is adjacent to a waterfowl area, the shooting hours on the CHA are basically waterfowl area hours, which is a half hour before sunrise to sunset, proposing changing that to match up with resident game bird shooting hours, which is half hour before sunrise to half hour after sunset. And proposing to add avian influenza and mycoplasma disease testing requirements if birds on a CHA are not sourced from a NPIP, National Poultry Plan Improvement source. This change is coming from some comments both from game bird growers and the state wildlife veterinarian and Department of Ag. Currently, avian influenza, mycoplasma, and salmonella are required for import permits to bring birds into the state. So this would just make this disease testing requirements consistent with Department of Ag import permits, and help alleviate some concerns and reduce some risk to the poultry industry within the state and also to chances of transferring disease to wildlife populations.
Any
proposing some changes for reporting requirements. Currently, the rule requires reporting by date as far as birds released and birds shot by customers. Proposing to change it just for requiring reporting by season. So we just need a total for the whole season rather than having it broken up by month. It would just simplify reporting requirements for the operators. And as far as the division's perspective, we really just need to know the scale of the operation. So that would cover, kind of give us a scale, an idea of what's going on out there. Currently in the rule, it requires mortality reporting for all mortalities on a commercial hunting area. But there's a regular, normal rate of mortality where either chicks, daled chicks often have some deaths, either the cold, not getting to food, or whatever. And then there's other normal mortality throughout the game bird growing process. If it's just birds running into the flight pen, netting and breaking their neck, or you get a predator getting in there or something. So we're proposing to change reporting requirements just for unusual mortality due to sickness, disease, bad feed, or other unknown causes. And would also be requiring immediate reporting for those unusual mortality events due to sickness, disease, bad feed, or unknown causes. And that would allow us to get out ahead or get out there early if there is a disease outbreak, or get in touch with Department of Ag to get on top of a case of bad feed killing a bunch of chicks and try and prevent further deaths. There's a few other additional wording changes within the CHA rule, but they do not change the meaning of the rule. Just add some clarity. Thank you.
Thank you, Avery. I just got one question. How many of these CHAs are we talking? Are there tens? I mean, is there like 70 or 80, or are there hundreds of them?
76.
76. Thank you.
That does include some of these CHAs that are broken up into multiple applications that are operating as a single CHA.
I assume when you had that circle one you had up there on the very one on the right where it had those three parcels, there must be roads or something dividing those, right? Because they looked to me like they were continuous.
Yeah, I guess that might not have been the best example. That one is, I think, up against acreage caps, but there are others that do have roads and stuff breaking them up.
Okay. Other question, Brother Rack. He must have done a bang-up job.
I have a question. Is it a requirement to release an extra amount of birds in case there are some wild birds taken through this? Is the idea just to provide hunting opportunity, or is it to try to maybe establish a little bit of upland game that may be taken accidentally through non-seasonal things?
Yes.
In September and January?
So I guess commercial hunting areas aren't there to establish wild populations, but when there's a CHA that is in an area with a, basically leave some to compensate for some wild birds that might be shot.
Is that a percentage that they?
It is a percentage.
Like the local one here, I'm a member to that, so I'm just curious on the Pleasant Valley Hunting Preserve, because there are local birds as well in that area.
Yep, I think it's 80%, but I would like to double check that.
Okay.
Other questions? Comments? Discussion? Entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to accept the plan as proposed.
That was Joe Arnold made a motion.
I'll second the motion.
Was that you, Rebecca, or Natasha?
Natasha.
Natasha hadn't seconded that. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Unanimous. Thank you, Avery.
If you did, I'll take it.
All right. You close? All right. We're ready for you.
Yeah, I'm good. Oh, don't wait for me. I'll catch up.
All right. Second presentation I've got for you tonight is a greater sage grouse population augmentation for the Sheep Rocks sage grouse management area. A little history on the Sheep Rocks and sage grouse in general in the state. So we've been doing LEC counts and have records going back to the late 50s. And if you look at those records over the long term, you can see a normal cyclic behavior. And you can see that in the blue line in the graph, where every 9 to 10 years we've got a high and a low, and they regularly cycle up and down. Oh, look, I even got a laser pointer. So, yeah, you can see the regular cycle. And that blue line there represents a statewide population for sage grouse. And if you look at that long-term trend of sage grouse in the state, you do see a slight long-term downward trend. And due to that downward trend, both in the state and range-wide, sage grouse have been petitioned for listing under the Endangered Species Act a number of times. But due to proactive conservation measures by the state, through both our plans and projects through WRI and other conservation programs, and basically just all the habitat work and everything we've done and the other states have done, they were not warranted for listing in 2015. Despite some of those conservation measures, the Sheep Rocks population continued down in after the bottom of the bottom of the cycle, 2011-2012. All of our other sage grouse management areas in the state, the population went back up as expected, but with the Sheep Rocks kind of decoupled from the rest of the state, and the population continued down. And you can basically kind of see right here where Sheep Rocks has continued going down, the rest of the state's going up, and as a result of that, kind of threw up a red flag for us. So we increased the amount of conservation work we're doing in the Sheep Rocks, primarily looking at pinyon juniper removals and also doing some stream bed restorations to try and increase brood habitat, coupled with some predator control and translocations. So the board approved translocations for 2016, 2017, and 2018. Over those 3 years, we moved 120 sage grouse, 90 females and 30 males. As a result of those combined efforts, we have kind of reversed the downward trend and are back going up where the population should be. And we should see that trend continuing up in future years. However, we would like to continue to do some translocations for some additional years. So I am here today requesting board approval for an additional 5-year extension to the Sheep Rocks sage grouse management area as a translocation release site. As sage grouse are a state sensitive species, there's a few additional requirements for translocation. So we need a management plan, which is in place. The request needs to go through the Resource Development Coordinating Committee, which it has gone through. And the final step is Wildlife Board approval. So we're looking at capturing birds on the Parker Mountain and Box Elder SGMAs and moving them to the Sheep Rocks. Those two populations are genetically similar. They're also very robust populations. We can take the birds out without significantly impacting those populations. It would be about 0.5% of the birds in the Box Elder and Parker Mountain that we're requesting to move. And it's geographically close enough where it's logistically feasible, but far enough where the birds won't just fly back to the area where they were captured. And we're planning to transport and release up to 40 sage grouse per year. So we've got plans to transport 40 this year, and then we've got a research project that will go on one additional year, so we'll collar those birds that we're putting out and then continue following them until their batteries are out. And then we'll also be monitoring the area through LEC counts to evaluate if we need to continue translocations beyond 1 year, but up to 5.
Thank you, Avery. I guess I got a question. I assume there's no hunting of sage grouse on Sheeprock. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep. The box elder and parker populations, we're taking them from our hunted populations, but the sheeprocks are not.
One other question is the are the ravens and or crows, are they a predator to these things? Do they eat their eggs? I guess that's something I've heard. I don't know if that's true or not.
They are primarily ravens, and we have contracted with Wildlife Services for some raven control in the sheeprocks.
Perfect.
Is the habitat work done along Cherry Creek Road part of this in the Vernon West Desert?
I'm not familiar with that exact project.
Okay. But
what kind of project is that?
Oh, I just noticed they tore out a whole bunch of junipers this year along the Cherry Creek Road in the Vernon West Desert, and I wondered if it was part
of
this.
Yeah, more than likely would be, yeah.
Okay.
Other questions? Concerns? Discussion? If not, we'll call for a motion.
I motion to accept the proposal as presented.
That was Natasha. Second. And
well, you're aggressive.
Who made that second?
I'll second.
Brad Horrocks made the second. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All right, unanimous. Thank you. All right, we've got one other little topic here that we're going to give our regional supervisor a minute.
I just wanted to take a second. Thank you for giving us a really good year on all these meetings. We're going to be taking a break here for a while, so we won't meet again until April 18th. That's when we'll be doing the big game permits, antlerless permits, CWMUs. I would propose that we have that meeting start at 5:30 again. The big game rule, those big game permits and the big game rule that we did this last time can run long. I like to try to make sure our meetings end by 10, so which we don't have to do, but it's good. Everybody has family, and it's good to get home at a decent hour. So I would like to start at 5:30 unless there's a problem with that.
Can we have that every meeting?
No, we try to do everything we can. Nice try, Tim. I would appreciate that, though.
We couldn't do it over two nights.
Well, I've just about done that before in my career, too. So thank you. Appreciate you all.
All right, thank you. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Adjourn.
That was it. Seconded by Tim Ignacio. All in favor? Yep. Thank you.